everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode of A Lawyer and a Policy Analyst Walk into a Bar. This is episode 5 of season 4, and we are talking today about the World Trade Organization. Is it in crisis, and what are the implications for us in the Caribbean? And joining us today, we have Alicia Nichols, who I don't think I can be faulted for labeling her as an international trade expert, but we will let her introduce herself in a little bit. But as always, I'm the lawyer, Jadrick Cummings.
And I'm Delano D'Souza, the policy analyst. We took a little bit of a mid-season break, but of course, yeah, we're back. And this is our Christmas gift to you. We're back, and we're going to give you about 3 or 4 episodes over the next couple of weeks. And so we look forward to that. As usual, we have a wonderful guest with us, an expert in her field in her own right, Alicia Nichols. And we're going to let her introduce herself, and then we're going to jump right into the pod. So, Alicia.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. It is my pleasure to be here in the bar with you guys. as you rightly said, my name is Alicia Nichols. I am a trade policy specialist. I am currently the founder of CaribbeanTradeLaw.com, and I also work at UE. In the Trudeau Rafael Center, but just to note that I'm speaking here in my personal capacity.
Of course, we have to give those disclaimers, as you know.
Yeah, most definitely.
So, like Jadrick was saying, we're going to be dealing with WTO today. Is the WTO in crisis? Of course, by WTO, we mean the World Trade Organization. Are we going to be looking at implications for the Caribbean? Now, as a little bit of a background, and Alicia, some of this is going to sound familiar to you, because in prepping for this, we actually went through a lot of your research and your writings, and it's always good when you can have a guest and you can actually reference them in what you're talking about. So that's good stuff. So just while we have a little background, the multilateral trading system was formed by the end of the Second World War with the creation of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, as we know, we refer to that as GATT. And really, it was to become the WTO in 1947, and this rules-based system has provided for the predictable and peaceful conduct of global trade for more than half a century to the benefit of the global economy, and we all benefit from that. Since its inception in 1995, and for the Caribbean, we would remember initially when the WTO came about, it was sort of with negative consequences for our agricultural trade, especially in bananas and sugar and so on. So we kind of had a bad introduction, so to speak, to the WTO and the principles that lie within it. And it has been, however, it has been the guardian of the multilateral trading system, and it has 164 members, and it accounts for over 97% of global trade, with 22 other countries currently in the accession process. So you could see this is a global institution. It represents so much of the trade that we see happening on a day-to-day. And of course, the organization serves not only as a permanent forum for negotiation of global trading rules among its members, but it's also a dispute settlement system. And it provides WTO members with an exclusive and compulsory system for the timely and order settlement of trade disputes. And we're going to get into a little bit more about this in a while. And like I said, some of what I just mentioned came directly from some of Alicia's writing, and it's wonderful to have her here with us. But we're going to start off the discussion, Jadrick and Alicia, speaking a little bit about the selection of the WTO Director General. Now, as we know, the former Director General, Roberto Azevedo, stepped down on August 31st, 2020, and a year before the expiry of his mandate, really. And it kind of, brought into focus the selection of a new Director General. And following his announcement in May 2020, the selection process was brought to bear, and it started, and it was launched then. But we've been having some challenges, and Alicia, that's why you're here today to discuss not only the challenges with the selection of the new Director General, but some of the issues that the WTO is having in general, so much so that some persons have labeled it a crisis in the WTO. So first and foremost, we recognize as well that when the process started, typically what would happen is that one of the deputy director generals would assume command of the institution. But we know that this did not happen on this occasion. So can you just tell us a little bit about why some of the members were unable to reach a consensus on selecting an acting director general, Alicia?
Sure. Thank you very much, Delano, for that very kind introduction and for setting the scene for your listeners. And I, first of all, want to applaud you for discussing this issue of the crisis at the WTO, because it's something that the average man on the street in the Caribbean is not really paying attention to, but really trade is central to our existence in the Caribbean. From the clothes on our backs, the phones that we use, the food that we eat, a lot of it is directly or indirectly sourced through trade or impacted by trade. So what happens at the multilateral level does have an impact on the average man on the street. So to answer your question, Delano, the WTO, as you rightly said, has four deputy directors generals, and with the announcement of then DG Acevedo's resignation, then one would ordinarily have been selected to act as the acting director general in the interim. So this is normally a very mundane thing, but what ended up happening is that the whole process, like many things at the WTO now, became very politicized. So
sound like the Caribbean, the boy. Oh gosh.
Yes. So what happened was is that the U.S. was insisting that the Deputy Director General Alan Wolf, who is a U.S. citizen, be the one to act as DG during the time. Now, bearing in mind that there are three others, there's one from Nigeria, one from Germany, one from China, and of course other WTO members, most notably the EU and China, were like, no, you know, you can't just dictate that it be the Deputy Director General from the US who takes over. So of course that led to the inability for members to achieve consensus on which of the DDGs would have assumed the acting post. So
when you at least not to cross you,
sure,
but when you say consensus, what do you mean? How is the decision made? Is it not a majority, or is it that everybody has to agree?
So everybody has to agree, and that's an anomaly in most intergovernmental institutions, as you will probably appreciate, in that the WTO is member driven. It operates on the principle of consensus, so every single member is supposed to agree, or in other words, let me put it another way, once there is no vocalization of dissent, then consensus is deemed to have been reached, right? So it isn't that you go to vote or anything like that, is that once there is no dissent expressed by at least one member, then the decision is taken as is. Now, of course, that benefits us as small developing countries. But then at the same time, you would appreciate that with an organization, which, as you rightly know, which has grown to 164 members, achieving consensus is not always easy. And that has been one of the reasons why, and we will get into it later in the podcast, why there has been crisis in the WTO and why there are calls for reform. But so to get back to the whole issue about the DDGs, because the US had voiced dissent, of course, there was no consensus. So what ended up happening was that it was decided that all four deputy DGs will continue to serve, you know, pursuant to their relevant portfolios. Each of them has a specified portfolio, with the advice of the chair of the WTO General Council, until such time as a new DG is selected.
It's very interesting. It was interesting to hear you speak about the fact that consensus has to be reached, and the fact that if there's a single dissenting opinion put forward, then that could run things afoul. And I don't know if you followed the part, but Jarek, you know, we would have had something similar, and you know my sentiments, and we would have discussed the United Nations Security Council and the Permanent Five and the veto powers and all of that.
Veto powers,
and we noted the kind of hegemonic power plays and so that tend to occur within these sort of landscapes. So that's interesting in and of itself. And there was no surprise to me to hear you say, Alicia, that the US said, okay, well, bam, this guy resigning early, you know, let's have our guy be the interim or the acting director general until such time as somebody new is appointed. But of course, as Alicia would have just explained, that never manifested because of the need for consensus.
But what I was going to ask Alicia as well is if there is any way, even if there is a dissenting voice, if there's any way that the other members can force a particular course of action, but not in relation to, I guess, the acting director general stepping in, deputy director general stepping in, but in terms of anything else, in terms of any of their other powers that goes up about in the actual process in the WTO.
Well, that's actually a good question, Jadrick. And that's actually where the value of the WTO DG comes in. And let me just state here definitively that the DG is not an all-powerful figure, but what the DG has is considerable soft power that they could wield. So in a case where, for instance, a member might not want to agree to a decision, there might be cases where the DG might be able to hold talks with the member or something like that, you know, in order to you know, achieve some sort of consensus, so to speak. And that's what you see a lot happening. Members holding bilateral consultations with each other, especially in very thorny areas of decisions, in order to achieve consensus. I must say, though, there is provision within the Marrakesh Agreement for voting, but this is not used to for the majority of the time. The focus is to try to get a decision via consensus. And let's face it, that is a lot more democratic, as you rightly said, when compared to other international organizations where the power dynamics are a lot more a lot more evident.
Yeah, man, I veto that. We just can't go forward dead in the water, you know. But I'm glad that you mentioned the power of the acting of the director general, and what it means to have one in place, because obviously if you don't have a director general in place, you're gonna run into problems. So basically the nomination period would have started, I believe, and at the end of the period we would have had, I think, 8 candidates have been put forward by their respective governments, and the WTO would have announced in July that the field of candidates would be gradually reduced following rounds of consultations with WTO members and so on. So can you kind of just break down the nomination and the selection process of the Director General to us, Alicia?
Sure. So the procedures for appointing the DG are actually outlined in a WTO document adopted by the General Council on December the 10th, 2002, and that's entitled Procedures for the Appointment of Directors General. And I should note that, generally speaking, this process is estimated to be about a 6-month process, but this had to be truncated, obviously, because the Director General was going to be stepping down in August, and a new one will obviously have had to be selected in time for that, which of course didn't happen. But in terms of the process, the chair of the WTO General Council of New Zealand, Ambassador Walker, he obviously, with the sanction of the members, came up with a 3-stage process, so to speak. So as you rightly said, there was a 1-month nomination period, which was from June to July the 8th of 2020. 8 candidates were nominated by their respective governments. So those would have been Mexico, Nigeria, Egypt, Moldova, Republic of Korea, Kenya, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and interestingly, the United Kingdom. And let me just say, all of them were very well-qualified candidates, and we could talk a little more later on. And then on July the 31st, it was decided that there would be 3 stages of consultations with WTO members starting September the 7th. So as I mentioned, that the aim is to come up with consensus by members on which candidate they believe would be better suited, right? So during this period, of course, in Geneva from July the 15th to the 17th, and those of us who are trade nerds had a field day with this, watching the candidates give their presentations to the General Council. Well, of course, that was a closed session, but then thereafter they had a press conference where each of them separately, of course, would have spoken and answered questions and stated why they're the best person for the job and what qualifies them and that sort of thing. And of course, their statements to the General Council can be found on the WTO's website for anyone who's interested. And during this time, this period was known as they made themselves known to the WTO period, so to speak. And that's when they would have been speaking to different delegations, introducing themselves. And some of them would have appeared on trade shows, different trade programs, trade podcasts and webinars and that sort of thing, just to get their, make their case. And then thereafter, it was announced after that first round of consultations that five candidates were advancing, and those would have been the candidates from Nigeria, Kenya, South Korea, UK, and Saudi Arabia. And then after that, there was a second round of consultations, and based on those, there were two candidates which advanced, and those would have been the candidate from Nigeria, Dr. Iweala, and the candidate from South Korea, who's the current Minister of Trade of South Korea, Minister Yoo Myung-hee. And what happened was is that while it was announced in October that Dr. Iweala was the candidate most likely to achieve consensus, the U.S. all of a sudden decided that they did not support her candidacy. They supported the candidate from South Korea. And the USTR actually published a statement on which they noted that they supported the South Korea candidate, who they argued was a bona fide trade expert. And that since the WTO was badly in need of major reform, it must be led by somebody with real hands-on experience in the field. So because of that, Dr. Iweala's has not been appointed as yet. And the meeting that would have led to that has been postponed to after the US election. So given the fact that is President Biden who is going to be taking over, President-elect Biden, who's going to become president, it would be interesting to see whether the U.S. changes its stance and supports Dr. Iweala.
I wanted to ask, Alicia, one of the first things you started out by saying was that it was interesting that the U.K. put forward a nominee. And I was wondering, why was it so interesting? Is that out of the norm?
No, it isn't, but to me it was interesting because it seemed to me as though they were making a stamp towards this whole, you know, they're talking about this whole Global Britain initiative that they're doing, so reasserting the UK's presence. Yes, so I found that very interesting, the fact that, you know, they really put their money where their mouth is and nominated someone for the position.
And also, there was nobody nominated, obviously, from this region. So I was wondering if there's no expectation that that would happen, or...
Well, I had suggested that it could, but really and truly, I really didn't believe that it would happen. Yes, we have had Caribbean persons head international organizations, and they've done magnificent jobs at that, but I really did not think that the Caribbean would really stick its neck out and nominate somebody, especially given the fact that it would need to be somebody that could be able to reach across the aisle, so to speak, and bridge what is a widening chasm between developing and developed countries.
Understood. So you didn't think that, well, one, if you said they wouldn't stick their neck out, that expression speaks volumes. And two, perhaps I don't know if there was any concern that they would not be able to get consensus on somebody coming forward from the Caribbean, and so therefore they opted not to, and perhaps support somebody else who might be able to kind of get that consensus that is needed. So that was interesting. Those are some of the things I think our listeners would wonder. I mean, you call all these candidates from all over the world, you know, very disparate places in terms of their socioeconomic background and so on, and their consequent and their what obtains currently for their economies and so on. So I mean, I was just interested as to why your thoughts on why perhaps nobody was put forward from the Caribbean. So I don't know.
Right. Well, no. The only thing I was wondering is because you were saying that initially America was behind Dr. Okonjo-Iweala, and then they seemingly changed after that. I was just wondering if it's just a case where more of your profile and qualifications go out the window, and then it just becomes a matter of political alignments and things like that in terms of this whole need for there to be a consensus and, you know, the whole nomination process for the Director General. But that's the only thing I was just wondering, if you think that's how it is.
Okay, the truth is I am not too sure if they actually have supported her before. I mean, she is a naturalized U.S. citizen. I'm not too sure if they have supported her. I do know that there was consensus among most WTO members that they around Dr. Iweala, but at the last minute, the U.S. Indicated that they supported Minister Yu. I am not too sure what was the reason of it. I try my best not to get in other people's minds. But it is interesting that despite the fact that she's a U.S. citizen and she's very qualified, that the U.S. didn't support her. And I'm wondering if it wasn't more of a power play than anything else.
All right. Okay. I got you.
Right. I had wanted to respond to something you had said, Delano. And in terms of why I think the Caribbean might not have put forward a candidate is another reason, the fact that for us, getting consensus on the most mundane things tends to be difficult. So, I mean, I'm just thinking about the whole fiasco that happened with the Commonwealth, Commonwealth SG position. You know, that was quite something to watch. So, given that, I really don't think that the region would A, have wanted to put forward a candidate, and B,
could we even find consensus among ourselves to put forward one person. That is in nature. That is the nature of the beast, unfortunately. But I like the fact you kind of walked us through the process itself. And I think in the end now, I think where we are is that we have two females who are up now. I guess they're the ones who are left and who are most likely to obtain consensus. Right. So if either candidate were to win the support of the WTO's diverse membership of course, 164, it would be the first in the organization's history, the first female director general after a quarter century of existence. So for me, I just kind of want to ask, as a woman in trade, and I know you're very passionate about trade and it's what you do, you live and breathe trade. What would this mean to you personally, and what would it mean for the field in general, a female director general of the WTO?
Okay, so I am very passionate about trade, but let me be honest, I'm not really big on the identity politics thing. I think I would not deny the fact that it is good to see possibly someone who looks like me in terms of phenotype and is a woman at the helm of the entity responsible for ensuring that the rules-based multilateral system works. So yes, that is a boon. But my main concern is the fact that I want someone who is qualified, and she's more than qualified. And the fact that she comes from Africa, a continent which has not seen a DG come from there as yet, I think that is something to be applauded. So I'm less hung up over the fact that she's a woman. I'm more enthused by the fact that she's someone who is coming from the African continent and someone who is extremely well qualified. And I think I know that there's been some concern over the fact that she doesn't have the institutional knowledge of the WTO, say like Minister Yu and some of the other former candidates. But sometimes I think that you need somebody from the outside to shake things up, and someone with different perspectives.
Fresh eyes, as we just say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that in that sense, she would be more than suited for the position.
Oh, well, definitely. And I know somebody, as you're a purist in many ways in terms of how you look at these things, I figure that you would be concerned more so about one, the person's background, the person's qualifications, as well as the perspective that they bring coming from Africa and having that knowledge of what it means for many of these lower income countries across the world, and kind of providing a voice, so to speak, for us. And I know a lot of persons are enthused because of that. But again, it comes down, and as Jadik said, and as a man to speak my mind on this part, to me, it's a power play. It is what it has been. I mean, we spoke about the UK putting forward Dr. Fox. We speak about these things because it's not just a matter of, you know, selecting a DG. It's a matter of them trying to kind of flex their hegemonic powers, in my mind at least, sometimes when it comes to these type of organizations. And I mean, and I'll tell you this, a lot of persons in the Caribbean are disenchanted with the WTO, not just because of how it was introduced to us via the fall of our agricultural our agricultural sector, but as well as what we've seen in terms of the settlement mechanism. I could think, for example, about Antigua and the US. So, you know, even before this whole DG election came about, there was a lot going on. So I just wanted to go back a little bit back in the past and speak about some of the problems of the WTO, even heading in or before this selection process. So on December 10, 2019, the World Trade Organization's appellate body, which of course you know is the highest arbiter for trade disputes, would have lost its quorum when the terms of two of its three remaining members expired. So we therefore see that even before this thing has started, this election of the DG, there were issues relating to the appellate process, among others. Can you speak to us and kind of educate us? Because for me as well as our listeners, this is an education, because I'll say this and I'll be very honest, we don't pay enough attention to the WTO and what it means for the Caribbean, and that's why we're discussing it today. So can you speak to us a bit about that whole loss of quorum, as well as go on to some of the issues that we've seen, or anything else you want to cover, as well as why this whole election process has perhaps been fraught with challenges?
Sure, Delano, and I think you're not giving yourself enough credit, because you speak to these issues with a good degree of familiarity and fluency, which is admirable, because these issues, while trade is very germane to us in the Caribbean, a lot of persons don't normally follow the issues going on at the multilateral level. So you, as you rightly said, even before
I like how you're gassing me up, I gotta take it.
Just being honest. So, as you already said, even before this whole issue with the leadership void, as it's called at the WTO at the moment, the WTO has been in what many observers have been describing as a crisis. And one of the things that really, I think, made international headlines, and let me hasten to say that even before the whole appellate body issue, there were problems that had been identified before the WTO is working, and the appellate body was just one of the latest of them. But as we are talking about the appellate body at the moment, I would just say that you are indeed correct that the appellate body is the As the name suggests, the second tier of what is the two-tiered dispute settlement system at the WTO. So you have the panel stage, which in lawyer speak would be the court of first instance. I know my international law friends will be like, oh gosh, do not conflate a municipal and international law system. Yeah, but just so persons who are listening could kind of make the connection, the panel stage like would be like the court of first instance. Exactly, whereas the appellate body would be the appellate stage where the appeals are heard. So for many years, the WTO was actually, the WTO dispute settlement system was considered the crown jewel. It's crown jewel because it was one of the best examples of state-to-state dispute settlement in international law. It actually worked to the satisfaction of most of the parties involved. So, and then another thing is that under the WTO's dispute settlement understanding, parties agree to submit disputes arising under any of the WTO's covered agreements. And that's unique because the WTO has exclusive and compulsory jurisdiction in disputes arising between members once it falls under one of the covered agreements, which is different from, say, the ICJ, whereas those who are legally minded know that with the ICJ, you know, you have to hear whether the court will first have to determine whether it has jurisdiction to hear the matter, those sorts of things. Whereas with the WTO, they have exclusive and compulsory jurisdiction in trade disputes arising between members once it falls under the covered agreement. So I just wanted to make sure that I let your listeners know about that. So, as I said, that's one of the reasons why it was considered the crown jewel. The WTO's dispute settlement was considered its crown jewel. But what ended up happening was that as successive US administrations had critiqued the WTO's appellate body's functioning.
Always the US, Jack.
Yeah. So, I mean, to To be honest, one or two other members have as well, but not to the extent that the US has, and it's been subsequent administrations. So I can't only say it's Trump in this instance, although it really blew up under him. But even before him, there were concerns arguing that the appellate body was overstepping. It was engaging in judicial overreach, you know. It was making, instead of, because at the appellate level, you are supposed to be making determinations based on law and not determinations of fact. And the US was arguing that what the appellate body was in fact doing in many circumstances was making determinations of fact, right? So and it's been a bipartisan issue.
But is it that the US was on the hand, was at the end of some cases that went against them over the years? That's why they've adopted that position. Or is it that they were independently speaking about cases that didn't involve them, but they felt that the appellate level was overreaching, or did it involve them and they felt aggrieved personally, so to speak?
That's a very good question. They felt aggrieved, but the thing is that if you look at the statistics, and I can't remember the exact number now, but I remember one of the statistics that I had read around the time when it was doing some writing on this, was that the US in fact wins about 80% of the cases in which it's involved in, whether as a claimant or a defendant. So the truth of the matter Antigua is that in many cases they're but that's the thing, it's true, right? And even then, you know, poor Antigua, you know, no end in sight, so to speak. They won the case even at the appellate level, and look where it is now. So, and that's something we'll speak about later. But yeah, so just to let viewers, listeners know that this whole issue with the appellate body was going on for a while now. But so what ended up happening was that the US was blocking renominations and nominations of judges in WTO speak. They're called appellate body members, but in layman speak, they're judges to the appellate body. So the appellate body, if I remember correctly, has 7 members, and they need 3 members for a quorum in order to hear an appeal. So what ended up happening is that, as you rightly said, Delano, in December 2019, when the terms of 2 of the remaining 3 members expired, then the WTO appellate body had no quorum, and basically it's been defunct since. And then in fact in November 30th,
hold on, since
year,
January 2019 it's been defunct.
No December since, I said January, sorry about that.
Since the last quorum, it hasn't been remedied, is what you're saying? Because to me there's a Marbyshop thing
none.
If since
yeah wow. There's none, absolutely none. Yeah, so what ended up happening was that some of the WTO members pushed by the EU, I would say encouraged by the EU rather, because push sounds a bit pejorative, I think, came up with this thing called the multi-party.
Sounds pejorative, but might still be accurate.
Well, yeah, very true. So the multi-party interim appeal arbitration mechanism, which sought to be like a interim mechanism whereby you could still have appeals. Any member which is part of the MPIA could still appeal panel decisions when they come out. But the thing is that yes, the EU is a member of the MPIA, yes, China, but then the US isn't a member of the MPIA, and the US is one of the most litigious WTO members. And then India also is not a member of the MPIA. So really and truly, for the majority of the WTO members, really and truly, if there is an appeal, is an appeal in a void, so to speak.
Yeah, I was gonna ask as well, because even if you have the MPIA, the fact that under the normal process the appeals, the results probably don't come to bear in any event, what would be the outcome under the MPIA? Because if on the normal way it takes a long time for your settlement to come through, then I mean, would the MPIA make a difference?
That's an interesting question. The thing is that I have not been following the MPIA as closely as maybe I should be. But I do know that there has been some discussion over like the current dispute now, the current potential dispute between Australia and China. There's been some talk about whether really and truly does it make any sense if Australia decides to make good on its threats against China and bring a dispute against China in the WTO, whether it would be a case where they would be appealing into the void. And one well-known WTO scholar was saying that not really, because since both of them are members of the MPIA, it would be almost as if the appellate body was still there. Now, I would also say that one of the reasons why the dispute settlement system of the WTO was so revered was the fact that, generally speaking, disputes were settled quickly. Generally speaking. So the whole issue with Antigua is an outlier, and one of the reasons being, of course, because it's a small state and unfortunately was going up against the US, right? So that's one of the things and one of the reasons why, in addition to the reasons that Delano had mentioned in terms of the impact that it has had in terms of our bananas, etc., that in some cases we still have a bitter taste in our mouth for the WTO in some instances. But then I always argue that without the WTO, it would be worse. It would be the law of the jungle. So I think we deal with what we have and we try to improve it.
So it's a deal with the devil, you know.
Yeah, you have to deal with what you have.
Yeah, I mean, I feel you, but I know, and we're doing it. Part of the reason why we're doing this part, like I keep mentioning, is because we really want our people to kind of look at this WTO thing again and kind of, you know, educate ourselves about it. But kind of just pivoting back now, because we mentioned the mobbishop nature of what's happening now in the WTO and all that. You know, we just speak frank on this podcast. You know, we mentioned the mobbishop nature of what's happening now in terms of no quorum for the appellate. Appellate level and all that. That's been going on for quite some time, and we could see a lot of power play happening here. And I mean, we spoke about the consensus before and how you said, you know, it was better than what we see in for example the UN Security Council and so on. But in my mind, it's almost the same, because if the US can single-handedly, you know, it's almost still like a veto power now. Because if you're saying to me that they can come up against reappointing or appointing some new judges to the appellate level, you know, then that kind of it rings true of the same thing to me, because it's basically the only difference is now is not the US alone can do it, anybody can do it. So it's more equitable in that way, but it's still a problem in the sense that, okay, you know, I guess what I'm asking is, wouldn't a majority decision be preferred?
That's actually an excellent point, and I think that's one of the reasons why there have been increasing calls, particularly interestingly from developed countries, to relook the whole consensus system of decision making. I think though that you have to be careful. Yes, I understand the a majority consensus, if you wish, or majority decision making might be better. But then you don't want a situation where it feels as though smaller states are being crowded out. At least here, everybody has a say, so to speak. It's something that minds more erudite than mine have been grappling with for years in terms of how to make the decision making at the WTO.
Let me give some gas. You gas me up all in the pot. Let me give some gas. I feel like you can handle this and you can you can pronounce on this and give us a good analysis of it. You know, your mind is among some of the most erudite in the region and globally.
I like that. Okay. I think it does need a relook. For sure. Whether majority decision making is that is something to be considered. I wouldn't say yeah or nay, because again, I also see the potential pitfalls of it. But I completely do agree with you that really and truly what the USA has been doing is effectively vetoing decisions that really would have been unanimous without the US, if the US hadn't vetoed the decision. So it does show that there needs to be a rethink there. Now, the thing is that the system for many years had worked, right? The system had worked for many years. And I think that one of the reasons why it isn't working anymore is because of the growing number of membership, the wider interests that have to be satisfied and those sorts of things. So if we do go with a majority decision making mechanism, I would still want to ensure that we still ensure that smaller states like ours, our voices are not drowned out.
I definitely feel you there, because like I said, although we're comparing in terms of veto power and so on, in this case, essentially any state has a veto power, quote unquote, if they were to express dissent. And of course, that for us in the Caribbean, the small islands, as well as those persons who are perhaps less socioeconomic on that ladder, I mean, they are in a position to still have their voices heard because of that whole notion of dissent. So of course we would want to keep something in that stead. I don't know, you're the mind for this here. But in kind of wrapping up and winding down the discussion, I wanted to pull back. I have two more issues I wanted to touch on with you. One of it stems from something you wrote in one of your articles. You wrote, regardless of which candidate eventually emerges victorious, she will have a monumental task on her hand, and that is she will have to save an organization which is badly in need of reform and facing mounting pressure. So my question to you is, based on what you've written, what are some of the most urgent challenges and how do you think they can be addressed?
Okay, sure. If we weren't in the middle of a pandemic, I would definitely have mentioned, probably as numero uno, the appellate body crisis. But given the COVID-19 scenario that we are undertaking, that we're going through at the moment, I would say that COVID-19 and its impact, particularly the impact that it's having in terms of the disruption of global supply chains, the impact that it's already having, on global trade, which already was being impacted by the rising trade tensions between the US and China. I mean, you're an economist, so I'm sure you follow all of the numbers, you know, the fact that both the WTO and IMF in their October 2020 estimates forecasted declines, not just for world merchandise trade for 2020 and 2021, but also for global GDP. So you really need a director of the WTO who would be able to command the support of the membership in terms of the need not to take unilateral and protectionist action at this time, because it would be counterproductive. The good news is that the last report that I saw from the WTO noted that there's been a reduction in the trade, both the trade facilitative and trade restrictive measures that members have taken. So, I mean, good and bad there. And that brings me to another important function that the WTO plays. The fact that despite the fact that, yes, the negotiations function is deadlocked at the moment, yes, despite the problems with the appellate body, the fact that the WTO still remains an important forum for countries, including countries as ours, who would not normally have a seat at the table of big players to discuss the impact of trade and how trade is being impacted by COVID-19 and other issues, and through its transparency mechanisms, etc. So another thing that the WTO DG will have to consider, of course, besides the appellate body crisis that we would have spoken about earlier, is also the trade tensions between the US and China. And to get even behind that, because that's really a symptom, right? It's a symptom of what a lot of countries feel is quote-unquote China cheating at world trade. I mean, in many cases that is overblown, but then in some cases there might be some kernel of truth to it, in that China, despite the fact that it is the world's second largest economy, continues to self-declare as a developing country. I mean, so you have the really mind-boggling circumstance where China is entitled to the same flexibilities, and by flexibilities I mean special and differential treatment under the WTO's agreements, as say a Barbados or a Mauritius, or, you know, I want to say LDCs, because LDCs, which are least developed countries, they have greater flexibilities. But really and truly, because it continues to self-identify as a developing country, then it has different longer transition times for implementing commitments, entitlement to certain development assistance, right? That's not the term I want, though. It'll come back to me. But under the WTO's agreements, another thing is that a lot of WTO members are concerned with the fact that a lot of China's state-owned enterprises are not disciplined. They're not disciplined under the WTO's rules. So that's one of the reasons why there's this tension now between WTO members in terms of agreeing to whether the current mandate for negotiations, which is the Doha mandate, should continue as is, when you have more 21st century issues that need to be discussed. This whole thing about rules, disciplining state-owned enterprises which engage in international trade, things like forced technology rules. Although China, I must say, has prohibited this under its new foreign investment law, there was some point in time, especially a lot of developed countries argue that China was requiring companies that wanted to invest in China to divulge technologies that they develop, right? Which of course would be infringement of their intellectual property rights. So there's that. So there's those trade tensions. So you have to manage those two behemoths. Then there's the negotiations function, as I alluded to briefly. Sorry, go ahead.
So you're saying obviously they have to contend in terms of the challenges with the COVID-19 pandemic and what that means for the body, the WTO body and trade in general. They have to contend with some of these. What's the second point?
My second point, I think I kind of rolled it into one. My second point would have been the appellate body crisis, but I had spoken to that earlier, so I didn't really get into it. Mm-hmm. So my third point would have been the trade tensions between the US and China. My fourth point, would have been the negotiations deadlock, or rather the inability to agree on the way forward for the multilateral negotiations. There are negotiations still taking place, but these are primarily plurilateral negotiations. And the issue of special and differential treatment. Should the WTO continue to allow countries like China and India to self-declare as developing countries and then
therefore
be allowed
access
to benefit
some of the benefits
for the flexibility
of
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So those are my main reasons. Sorry I took forever to get there, but all of them are kind of intertwined.
Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to kind of summarize our listeners could kind of pinpoint exactly where we're going with the discussion. And of course, you know, we always have to bring it back to our region, to the Caribbean. And I mean, like we would have mentioned before, as with a lot of, all of these international, multilateral institutions and so, there's a lot at stake for small states like those in the Caribbean. So in the past, we have seen examples of Caribbean states being disadvantaged by the WTO processes and enforcement of judgments, etc. We would have spoken to the US Antigua gambling dispute earlier in the pod. Unfortunately, it appears typical in the Caribbean that we have not largely shown interest in these selection processes and the appointments and the day-to-day running of these institutions. So, I mean, you've written several pieces about it. And of course, I try to keep up with the readings and so on. So what I really want to ask you, can you speak to what the selection process and the WTO, what it means for us in the Caribbean in general? And can you speak to us about some of the issues that you've highlighted in your writing, as significant to the CARICOM region in particular?
Sure. And let me say that, I mean, at least you guys are doing your part in terms of raising awareness of these issues, because as you rightly said, these are issues that the average man on the street doesn't really think about. And the truth is that all of our CARICOM member states, with the exception of the Bahamas, which is currently in the accession process, are WTO members. So really and truly, what happens at the WTO affects us. So, and as I mentioned before,
hold on, Alicia, not to cross you.
Sure.
So, the Bahamas is not in the WTO. They're in the accession process.
No. Yeah, they're.
That's interesting.
In the
I ain't gonna say nothing there.
Yeah, it is. It is really Very interesting. In fact, they have a very powerful anti-WTO lobby within their country. A lot of their private sector does not want them to be a part of the WTO, which is really interesting. So that is why what happens at the WTO affects us. So, and it's not just in terms of, as I said, the trade negotiations, but as a forum for the peaceful settlement of trade disputes, but also in terms of monitoring and ensuring transparency and capacity building support that we get from the WTO as well. So I would say that the rules-based system is important to us, and for that reason, whoever becomes WTO DG, even though they are not an all-powerful person who wields a considerable amount of power, they are somebody who could exercise soft power, and you will want somebody that is in tune with some of the issues that affect developing countries as well, right? So that's why I say that having someone like Dr. Iweala is a potentially good thing, because she knows both sides. She knows it from her lived experience in Nigeria, being Minister of Finance for Nigeria, but also the developed country side by being the number two at the World Bank. Another thing is that because why it's important for us at least to have a WTO which regains some sort of legitimacy is the fact that you want the rules for international trade to be made in a multilateral forum where we at least have a seat at the table. And what you found happening was because of the stalemate in the negotiations, a lot of the rulemaking on trade has been taking place in regional trade agreements. I almost said RTAs. Forgive us, but you know how it is in our professions. We like to use a lot of acronyms and abbreviations and those sorts of things. So you've had several large RTAs being signed. You had the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which of course the US pulled out of, but now they have the comprehensive, I can't remember the full name, but it's the CPTPP now. Then you recently had the RCEP. What those mean is that a lot of the times trade rules on new and emerging areas, because they're not being dealt with in the multilateral system, are being dealt with in these these separate regional trade agreements where we have no seat at the table. So it means that by the time, if they ever do come to the multilateral system, then they will already be taken as this is the gold standard, take it or leave it, so to speak, right? Another thing is that we will want a well-functioning WTO dispute settlement body. Yes, as for the reasons that we've enumerated, it has not worked optimally for small states, as we saw with the US Antigua gambling dispute. But at least the thing is, Antigua won, right? It was a paper judgment, if you want to call it that, which would be the akin in municipal law, but you know,
at least they get a moral victory.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's a moral victory. Yeah, it's a paper judgment, but it's at least a moral victory. Something that in the law of the jungle, if you did not have a dispute settlement system like that, Antigua would not have at least gotten that paper justice, if you want to call it that. So I think that yes, even though we know that there are significant issues that need to be addressed with the WTO, I think we're better with it than without it. I think that once we are engaged, and a lot of our delegations are engaged, one of the biggest problems we have is the fact that a lot of, especially the OECS countries, don't have resident delegations there, right? They have the mission, yes, but that's only two people, if I remember correctly, two technical officers there. And even those of us like Barbados or Trinidad or Jamaica, Guyana, who have full missions there, they're still small delegations, so you can't go to every meeting. But the fact that at least we are members of the association means that we could at least give our voice to what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way
I can agree. Fully agreed. Well, guys, I mean, I think the discussion has been fruitful. It's definitely been, we touched on a wide range of topics and issues surrounding the WTO. I just kind of want to move us into our final segment, the usual segment, where we raise our glass to something that's happening. Well, Alicia, you've listened to the pod before, so I'm going to ask you to raise your glass to something. What are you drinking to this week, Alicia?
I am drinking to a long-awaited vacation.
And I'm hoping you're enjoying
that.
I'm
sure you would agree.
Yes, definitely. What about you, Jarek? We could raise our glass to that. What about you, Jarek?
Raise our glass to that. I am gonna take a bit of a cop out. Given that I think our last episode was right before our elections, and maybe was it before America's elections? But anyway, I just want to raise my glass to the culmination of all those elections and everybody going out and exercising their rights to vote, and nothing coming of it in terms of St. Vincent anyway, in terms of any big dispute or anything, unlike our last election in 2015. But I am raising our glass to everyone exercising their right to vote and us having a successful election.
Well, to democracy, we should raise our glasses to that. For me, guys, I just want to raise my glass to the approval of and the development and the approval of these COVID-19 vaccines. I'm looking forward to the rollout, and I'm looking forward to our lives returning to some semblance of normalcy over the next year or two as we roll out this vaccine globally. So I really just want to raise my glass to the amazing scientists and practitioners who've brought this thing to reality. So I want to raise my glass to that.
Definitely. Could definitely raise our glass to that.
So, Alicia, thank you for being here with us. It's been an education.
And thank you, gentlemen. I truly enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for being on the pod. Hopefully, we'll have you back again sometime. Maybe when they pick an actual director general, we could have some more discussion on it.
Sure. Whenever you guys are ready. I am always happy to discuss trade. As Delano knows, I'm a trade nerd. So, anything trade, I live, breathe, and eat.
Yes, you hear that. So, again, everyone, we want to thank you for listening to another episode of A Lawyer and a Policy Analyst Walk into a Bar. I'm the lawyer, Jared Cummings.
And I'm Delano D'Souza, the policy analyst. Catch you next time.